Going Linux, episode 222, Listener Feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Bill.
Whether you are new to Linux, upgrading from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in going Linux.
We hope that you find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done. In today's episode, Listener Feedback. Hey, Larry, how you doing this week?
Another wonderful week. It just gets better and better. So, awesome. How about you?
Great. I start my new job tomorrow. I'm very excited.
Yes, congratulations.
Yes, thank you. No more big corporations. Get to go back and do things I like. Can't wait. I've been playing with Elementary OS. A lot of fun. I've been posting little tidbits on our Google Plus.
I've been following that. I see your latest screenshot. Looks kind of gamesmanlike.
Well, you know, it lasted a little over about two and a half weeks, and now I had to put my work desktop back on, but it was a lot of fun. Okay. Really good. Yeah, so it was a lot of good. They do a lot of things right. I put a few observations that you made about it, about, you know, maybe putting Firefox or Chrome or inputting, you know, some different applications that people actually would recognize.
Sure. Yeah. Well, to each his own. Are we going to have a review on Elementary OS?
Of course. Of course.
All right. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, we are getting listener feedback. And how many voicemails do we got today?
We've got one. It's about a month old. So, Robert, sorry you got this to us just after we recorded the last listener feedback. So we're getting it in this one. Let's listen to it, shall we?
Okay.
Hi, Larry and Bill. Yeah, I hope you can get this and it's clear. I've got about two bars on my phone. I think since the forum, the Linux or the Ubuntu forums have been hacked, I think mine might have been one of them because all my email accounts, I can't access them. And I've been trying to change passwords a couple times. And the only one that I was able to access is Google. And I tried to send you a email, hopefully, and you know, it said it was sent, so hopefully you get it. I don't want y'all to think I'm not gonna try to reconnect. I'll probably get another Google account, but I'm gonna take your advice and be more strategic with my passwords and things this time around. And I don't know. I had my Yahoo account forever, so anyways. Y'all take care, and once I guess it's all over, I'll be in touch. All right. Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks, Robert, for the voicemail. Get a chance. Let us know how that's worked out for you. Sorry you have been having problems. So what do you think, Larry?
Yeah, I agree. Robert, it's been a month. You've probably got it all resolved. Just let us know how it turned out.
Yeah. Do that.
Okay, our first email is from Kevin, who provided us some feedback on our open source licenses.
Okay, let's listen to what Kevin has to say.
Yeah. Kevin writes, "Hello, Larry and Bill. As always, I enjoy your latest podcast about software licenses, but I do have some feedback. All too often, I hear discussions of licenses that are devoid of all useful context, and an example is saying one license is, quote, better or, quote, worse than another license. I would argue that each license needs to be addressed on its success in achieving the goals it sets. And to say one license is freer than another begs the question of freer in what sense. You may remember the famous quotation by the the jurist Oliver Wendell Holmes that, quote, "Your right to swing your fist ends where my nose begins," unquote. Would you say this reduces the freedom of the first swinger? Probably yes, but that is bad. Or does the freedom of the nose owner account for anything? Richard Stallman has always been very clear that his aim is to preserve, to the maximum extent possible, the freedom of the software user. So to call the GPL more restrictive without putting it in context is misleading. From the standpoint of the end user, it is the least restrictive because it does the most to preserve my freedom. As a counterexample, consider Apple and BSD. BSD famously has very non-restrictive license, which has allowed Apple to take open source software and turn it into a product that tightly restricts the freedom of the end user. If your primary goal in writing the software is to get it to as many products as possible, then you don't really care about the freedom of the end user. A license like BSD is more suitable to those aims, but how does that make it any better or freer in any absolute sense? Kevin. Well, Kevin, you make a lot of good points, and we hope to get into some of these in our advanced episode on licenses, and we appreciate the fact that you're highlighting the point that these licenses have two sides to them. There's the user of the software and the developer of the software. And licenses like the GPL are ostensibly to protect the user's rights so that when they are using the software, they can be sure that it is free in the Free Software Foundation sense of free, free with a capital F. And if you are using something like the BSD license, like in your example, it is not protecting the freedom of that software from the same perspective. My point in talking about more or less restrictive was this, that from the developer's perspective, the GPL is more restrictive. Because if you license your software under the GPL, the next developer that is going to use your software or derive additional works from your software has no choice as to which license to license it under if you licensed it under the GPL version 3. You must license derivative works under GPL version 3 if that's what the original software was under. So from the developer's perspective, it is more restrictive. But you're right, Kevin, from the user's perspective, if you follow the Free Software Foundation's doctrine, yes, it is more free and better from that perspective, from the user's perspective. But if your interest is, as a developer, getting your software out to as many people as possible and allowing anyone to use it in any way they see fit, then the BSD might be the better license for you.
Yeah. Well, you know, reading Kevin's email, I have a few observations. One is there's two GPLs, a version 2 and version 3. Mm-hmm. Version 3 is more restrictive than version 2. So he just used one GPL in his examples. And so, you know, to be totally fair, you can't treat a software package that's licensed under GPL version 2 as the same as you would one with GPL version 3, because they're different.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And neither one is better or worse.
No.
As Kevin says, you have to put it in context, and the context would be, what is your goal in licensing or in using the license? And you can also not use the term better or worse for the same reason. You have to put it in context.
Yeah. The one thing that I keep noticing is some of these licenses are not, I would call them a little bit unbalanced. Either they're all for the user or they're leaning more toward the developer. And the reason that we say the BSD is like, you know, you can use it for anything is that they've if you want as many people to use it any way they can, you just license it under that. So it's keeping everything in perspective. I'm not saying it's better than the GPL. I'm just saying, when you look at the licenses and you're writing software, you got to kind of see how much, is it in balance for what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. Right. And the GPL puts quite a few more restrictions, contains many more restrictions on what the developer can do, to the point where under the GPL3, you have to license the next work under GPL3 as well. And that protects the GPL. It protects the user's right to ensure that any subsequent software also uses the GPL, but it's the restrictions in the GPL, and we'll get into this when we get into the advanced episode, what the restrictions are. It's those restrictions or those clauses or those conditions in the GPL that allows it to do that. And because the BSD license doesn't have, or the MIT license doesn't have those same restrictions, from a developer's perspective, it is I don't want to use the term freer in the sense of a free software foundation, but it allows you more freedom to license the next work in whatever way you want. So it depends on what your goal for the software is. It depends on what your goal in using that license is. And it depends on what it is you're trying to protect. Are you trying to protect the propagation of free software licenses, or are you trying to protect the developer's right to make a decision as to what license to use for their software?
Okay, well, we can cover a lot more of this in our advanced episode, so stay tuned.
But thanks, Kevin. Very good.
Yeah, thank you.
Very good email.
A lot of good points. Our next email comes from Fuzzy, who wrote in to give us some background on GPL for our discussions on open source licenses. Fuzzy wrote, "I can't help but mention that you may not have told the full story related to the GPL. In the olden days, when open source projects were just getting off the ground, there was a fear that the project would be forked by a corporation, copyrighted, and be granted a retroactive court decision requiring everyone using the original software to pay a licensing fee. Whether or not this actually happened, I have no clue. However, the myth was pervasive enough among programmers that the wording in the GPL was born, requiring any forks to remain free. Nowadays, with the ease of proof of prior works on the internet, such a restrictive license appears to go against its original intentions, yet the fear may still remain. Thanks, Fuzzy."
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I wasn't aware, mainly because I wasn't in software development at that point, about the fear back in the olden days, as Fuzzy wrote, about the licensing being usurped by corporations. And I can understand the desire to protect licenses. So from an interesting historical perspective, very good point.
Yeah, very good point. Thanks, Fuzzy.
Okay, our next email is from Andrew. And he started a new website about Linux on an Ubuntu-based server, and I've helped him get his server up, and he has now got his Linux website up and running. And his email is, "Do you know how I can get my website, www.taalinux.com, out there and known for free?" And one way to do that, Andrew, is to get me to read your email on the Going Linux podcast. And another way is, you might want to, you've got a lot of good things on your website, a lot of good resources and links to other things. And so one way that you can get the word out about your website is to begin to let people know that it's out there by going on forums where people are looking for help, find some posts where you can help people, and where appropriate, send them to a link on your website for the answer or for some additional information that might help them out. Now, don't overdo this and don't only answer the questions that allow you to point back to your website. I mean, that's just bad form. Genuinely help people. That's the key thing. And it looks like your website has the goal of helping people to adopt Linux. So I would say that the best way to get your word out there is to mention it to people as you're helping them to learn how to use Linux or how to adopt Linux. It's kind of what we do.
Yeah. You also can send an email to some of the other Linux podcasts and just ask them to mention it also. That's another great way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And the best way to keep that that website popular and adding value is to make sure that you have good content on the site. Make
Absolutely.
Sure that it doesn't just sit there and nothing changes and, you know, put out some good content, help some people on the site as well.
Yeah. Our last email for this episode was sent to us by Roy, who has varied success with UNetBootin. He writes, "Hi, guys." Hey, Roy.
Hey, Roy.
"After listening to episode 219 to the question on UNetBootin, I have a couple of thoughts. I have used UNetBootin for many years. I have had various levels of success over the years. First off, if the user is not seeing the USB key, then he or she needs to mount it before opening UNetBootin. The easiest way to do this is to use the file manager to open it. I usually do this to see the contents of the USB key first, since I reuse them to delete previous distros. Since UNetBootin does not have a format option, I have a few USB keys that will not work for various reasons. The second thing is UNetBootin does not work with all distros. You can only find which ones by trial and error. When all else fails, I make a bootable DVD or CD on a rewritable disk. Sometimes that is the only way. You can also try the Ubuntu tool, Startup Disk Creator. I have had good success with this, but judging on the comments of the Ubuntu Software Center, this is not the universal opinion. I have been listening for years, and you continue to keep things fresh and interesting. Great work. Thanks for all that you do to help people out in going Linux. Cheers, Roy." Thanks, Roy.
Yeah, what's your experience been with UNetBootin versus the Startup Disk Creator on Ubuntu?
I used a Startup Disk Creator a couple times. I didn't have much success with it. I've had better success with UNetBootin. I found that going to the website instead of getting it out of the repositories seems to give the freshest version of UNetBootin, and it seems to work better. It could be just in my mind.
Yeah.
I found that the main distros such as Debian, Ubuntu, Fedora, Sabian, OpenSUSE all seem to work better than some of the variants. This seemed like the closer you are to the mainstream, the better they do, with various levels of success. I will say I used to have that problem with the USB keys that, you know, after I'd use them, they would stop working and I couldn't do anything with them. There is a trick. If you still have access to a Windows system, you can use it to format it back to FAT32, the USB key. And then usually you can, it'll work perfectly again. I don't know why it is, but that was one little trick that I've tried. He might want to try it and see what he thinks.
Yeah, and if you really don't want to go back to Windows to do that, if your distribution doesn't already have it installed by default, you can go back and get gparted from the repositories and do the format that way, or simply use the command line to format the USB sticks. So either way will work. And my experience with UNetBootin has not been the same as Roy's. It really has worked for me regardless. There was one version of it, one iteration of it, that it had a few problems. But since then, it has worked flawlessly. I really don't use it too much because I'm usually on Linux Mint and they have their own USB image writer tool. But when I do need to make a USB stick from Windows at work or some other system that that isn't Linux Mint, I'll download Unetbootin and make the bootable software from there. I really don't mind older versions of Unetbootin as well, because I rarely use its capability of downloading the image before it does the copy, because I usually have the image that I'm looking for to begin with, and I just use that image to write it to whatever the removable media is.
I always forget Gparted. Gparted is a great tool. I've used it hundreds of times. I don't know why I always forget to mention to Gparted. It's just like one of those tools you just take for granted.
Yeah, and many of the newer distributions as well that haven't been around that long have some sort of tool built in that's not Gparted. There's a in Peppermint OS, for example, there is a utility. I forget the name of it right off the top of my head, but there's a utility where you can get information about the disk. It may maybe simply disk info or something, but it's a graphical utility that you can go get the information from the disk. And if I'm remembering this correctly, it allows you to do partitioning and reformatting right from that utility that comes with the Peppermint OS. And there may be other distributions that have provided their own utility for doing this sort of thing.
Yeah,
lots of options, Roy. And thanks for the email.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Well, we have one more email. This one,
we do.
Yeah,
you snuck it in.
Yes, this one is a Linux in the Wild from David. Why don't you go ahead and read that?
Okay, since you snuck it in on my side, I guess I will read it.
All right.
David writes, "This might not count because it seems to be a community-driven project, but I watched their little ad on YouTube and spied their laptops running Ubuntu. That's pretty cool." And he writes that he saw it on the Air Force, an Air Force ad.
Yeah.
They're running Ubuntu. That's cool.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. He's got a PS at the bottom of his email there, Bill.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. PS. I keep forgetting to write, but the last time I went to my local auto oil changers, I noticed that they use Ubuntu on their computers. Huh. Auto oil changers. Is that a company?
Well, he's got it capitalized, so I'm assuming it's a company. So it may just be a regional one in his area. I don't recognize the name.
Well, that's cool. They don't have to pay software licenses to use it. I mean, and really, that Ubuntu with just the standard packages from their repositories would probably excel at doing invoices and stuff like that.
Sure. Sure. Absolutely. And so that was a 2-for-1 from David on Linux in the Wild.
So do you have any software picks, Larry?
Well, as a matter of fact, I do. And I didn't write it in our show notes here, but there is something that I stumbled across not too long ago that is really, really handy. And it's cross-platform. So this is one I might actually submit over to Nightwise for the Nightcast. And that is something called Mighty Text. And what Mighty Text is it's a little browser plugin for Chrome and Firefox that allows you to use your browser to send text messages through your phone. And you can actually receive them as well. So if you're the kind of person like me who sends text messages with my thumbs on the keyboard on my Android phone, and you'd rather not do that, you'd rather use the keyboard because you're usually sitting at your computer, you can open the browser, open the Mighty Text website, and it's actually an application in Chrome, a Chrome applet or whatever it is they're calling them these days. And it puts your text sending window on the screen, and you can have multiple chat sessions or text message sessions going on with multiple people simultaneously.
That's
on
so
your
cool.
browser. Right. So it works like a chat window, but you're sending text messages. Of course,
but you send it through your cell phone, though.
Yes, you're sending it through your cell phone. So I'm not sure how the technology works, but it appears to connect through your mobile telephone to use this. So you still receive the text messages on the phone and your sent messages still appear on the phone as well, but you can manage it all from within the browser, which is, for me, very handy.
Yeah, I have a, it's not really a software pick, but it is software.
Okay.
I was using Elementary OS for a while, and their interface is called Pantheon.
Yes.
And anybody that gets a chance, really check it out, because Pantheon is fast, and it really, really is an awesome interface. It's fast, it's fluid, it's customizable. I sound like a total fanboy now, but they do such a nice job. I really want to see that distro succeed. If I didn't have so much tied to my Ubuntu Studio, and you know, I have so many apps, because I've made a image of all the stuff, because you know, I can't keep reloading stuff all the time, so I just blast the image back onto my machine. I would use that Elementary OS almost exclusively, but Ubuntu Studios, you know, I've got so much tied with it right now. It's still my main workhorse. I'd love to use Pantheon on Ubuntu Studio. That'd be an awesome thing. So, okay, now I sound like a fanboy. If you're in between distros or you just want to create a live DVD, try Elementary OS and see what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and of course it comes as the default desktop mm-hmm. environment on Elementary OS, but it's available for other distributions as well. So I noticed that there are mentions of it on the Arch Linux wiki and mm-hmm. other places as well. So this might be something that you could try on your favorite distro if you don't want to switch to Elementary OS. But in the time that I've tried out Elementary, I really like it a lot. So, and the desktop environment is just one of the things that I like about it.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe I'll see if it's in the Ubuntu repositories and see what it does to my Ubuntu Studio.
Yeah. I don't know whether it's in the repositories, but certainly there are ways to get it installed.
What PPA might find a PPA for it?
Yeah, there's an article. I'll put the article in the show notes. It's
okay, cool.
It's an Ask Ubuntu article on how to install Pantheon on your Ubuntu. So that might work out for you.
Yeah, awesome.
Looks like it is a PPA, by the way.
Oh, awesome. Okay, our next episode is what, Larry?
Our next episode is something I'm not looking at because I am getting that link. Let me just put the link in here before I forget.
Sure.
Okay. Okay, yeah. So there we go. Ask Ubuntu. All right. So our next episode is Computer America, number 67. And until then, of course, you can go to our articles and show notes at goinglinux.com, the website for computer users who just want to use Linux to get things done. And if you want to support our efforts, please click the donate button while you're there on our site. We really appreciate it.
You can download episodes directly from our website, or you can play them right from the show notes page. Or better still, go to subscribe.goinglinux.com to learn how to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. Do it now.
Send us your feedback. We'll play your audio files or your voicemail messages on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com, and our voicemail is 1-904-468-7889, and that's 1-904-4 our tux.
And remember to leave your topic suggestion on our forums at forum.goinglinux.com or participate in our Google Plus community. Look for Going Linux Podcast.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
73.
Music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.